Can't Say That is a sociology podcast that poses more questions than answers. Join your hosts, Drs. Nama Carlin and Melanie White, in a journey to make the familiar unknown.
I'll start us off. Hello, everyone, and welcome to You Can't Say That. My name is Melanie White, and I'm here with...
Nama Carlin.
Hi, Nama.
Hi, Melanie. Such a nice day.
It is. It is absolutely freaking hot.
Yeah, I know. This studio is... There is no air conditioning, so it's very hot here.
I think we may be experiencing some butyric acid soon.
Wow. Very relevant to our podcast.
Indeed. That was a pretty heavy-handed segue into our consideration of today's thinker named Jakob von Uxkull. And his name is the most complex name I've come across in quite a while. It's spelt with a capital U-E-X-K.
Umwelt?
No, his name, Uxkull.
Oh, yeah, so Uxkull. Oh, the U's got the Umwelt.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, that's right, Umwelt.
Oh. Uxkull
or no, Umwelt? No, Umlaut.
Oh, Umlaut. Well, that was an Umwelt was another segue. We're doing
That's
really
right.
well today.
Okay. So,
Jakob von Uxkull.
Yeah. Jakob, oh, Jakob von Uxkull.
Okay.
Capital U E X K U with an umlaut, double L. So he is actually not a sociologist, not a philosopher, not a primatologist what? Or a psychiatrist or literary critic. He is a behaviorist. Is that right?
Zoologist, behaviorist.
And if he is, I don't know why I heard. He's not just a behaviorist. He is the behaviorist because he was the founder of behavioral physiology, otherwise known as the School of Ethology. And so he was affiliated with the University of Heidelberg and the University of Hamburg and was born in Estonia in 1864.
At what period did he was he writing?
So he was writing around the early to mid 20th century. And so he died in 1944. And one of the reasons why he's so interesting is that as our podcast has been moving along, he offers an alternative conceptualization, explicitly challenging someone like Descartes, for whom animals are conceived of as machines, and offers a conception of self that is plastic enough that it extends to both human and non-human animals, and in fact to all living things.
So interesting. So he's basically following on from De Waal, which also accommodated or looked at the idea of empathy as a building block of morality and something we share with at least some non-human animals, especially primates. Moving on then to Bergson, who thought of time, life in terms of time and experiences of life itself, defining the undefinable or describing the indescribable. Jakob? Uxkull?
Uxkull?
Uxkull brings everything together in a very interesting way.
One of the things that I like about him is that he's kind of got that, we could call it a dimorphic approach to writing. Someone might say it's dual. On the one hand, it's really extremely scientific. And so this is perhaps less the part that I am interested in, but he's got this really lyrical quality of writing.
Yeah.
And it just breathes air into what would otherwise be a very dense text. And I think it's that interesting combination that really captures the attention and encourages one to move through the text.
I really like your point here because it reminds me of this text that we're looking at. He sort of invites us to take a stroll in a garden. We'll get to that part, but it's that invitation to come take a stroll.
Mm-hmm.
And it really reminds me of C. Wright Mill, his invitation to sociology.
Mm.
Oh, is that Mill or is that Berger?
C. Wright Mill's uses an imagination.
Oh.
And Berger is the invitation.
Well, both of them, key sociologists,
are pleasant and use the imagination.
The imagination.
And they invite.
So I just, it's a ridiculous connection. But I'm, yeah, clutching at spanners, but we'll make it work.
What is a spanner to you?
What is a spanner?
Yeah.
Like a wrench?
A spanner, wrench. Mm-hmm. So clutching at spanners. So it's interesting. My formulation would be clutching at straws.
You know why, Melanie?
Why?
Have you ever seen Cat and Kim, the TV show?
No.
No? You have to. It's a wonderful TV show. But it's where I learned to speak a lot of my English phrases and Australianisms. And they take these terms and they kind of bastardize them. So, yes, it's clutching at straws, but they use clutching at spanners. The same as you're the Bea Marie of my existence.
Ah, got it. So I will definitely. You know what I can do is I can just make them up myself.
And just Cap and Kimisms. But yes, okay. So it is a clutching at straws.
Okay, I understood. A straw in the works. Here we go.
Well, okay. So Uxkull, it claims that every living thing exists in the world that has a unique meaning to it. This is where his idea of the Umwelt is developed. And what is that informed by, this idea of meaning and sign?
Well, it is informed by a semiotic perspective that looks at the relationship between signs, that is, what exists in the world versus how it's represented and what meaning is associated with that representation and that thing in the world. And so for Uxkull, he was very interested in thinking, okay, so there's a basic division in the world. There is the me, Melanie, and then there is all that is not me. And some elements of the not me will be of interest to me. Things like spanners and straws and among other things. And those are things that actually quite seriously, those are things that will inform and influence and help one thrive in the world. So certainly human beings have quite a complicated not me. There are many signs and symbols and different forms of stimulus that the human being receives and then orders into a full-blown worldview such that one can have a very distinctive world vis-a-vis another. And Uxkull calls that world a
Umwelt.
An Umwelt, not an Umlaut. That's right. So who knew that this would be rudimentary German for all of us? Though you are a German speaker, aren't you?
Oh, I know how to say one thing in German.
Oh.
Mein Schuttgrotter hat einen Dudelsack. Mein Schuttgrotter hat einen Dudelsack. Melanie's cracking up.
I have just been rendered speechless.
Well, if anyone knows what this means in German, I do. You can tweet at us.
Okay, oh dear me. I think it must be naughty. Well,
I do know one naughty thing in German. Hmm. Nicht mein Po.
Well, I know that's not my...
Bum.
Oh gosh, we can't
say that.
We can't. Oh my goodness, now we are digressing. Nobody wanted to. We're here to talk about the Umfeld.
Yep.
And not the potty humor.
Okay, you take it away.
Okay, so for Uxkull, the Umwelt is basically the world in which a living being, an organism, lives. And it is the world that is experienced by that living being and that organism. And each world is unique or distinct to that organism. So, Nama, you have a worldview.
Yes.
That is your own, and it is distinct from mine, as it's distinct from any other living being that we can think about. And what's interesting is that the way that Uxkull approaches this is to say that for each living being in their world, there are certain things that are important to it, certain things that the living creature will respond to for nourishment, for sustenance, for pleasure, etc. And so he essentially conducts a bit of a mapping exercise to determine what is significant and in what sequence of time for each living creature. And again, that the whole idea is to somehow flatten out that typical privilege that is accorded to human beings and their selfhood by saying, hey, it's not just human beings who have an umfeld. Scorpions and spiders and sea snails and turtles and donkeys actually also exhibit their, have their own umfelds, and they can actually design and function within those umfelds.
Does he consider it in terms of the individual being or as a species existence?
Do you know something? I'm not entirely sure. I mean, I think that for less developed organisms, it would be from the vantage of a particular species. But then as evolution takes over and one considers the vantage of a human being, what's interesting about a human being vis-a-vis other living beings is that human beings can interpret not only our own umfeld, but the umfeld of others. And so that is to say that we can adopt and a perspective outside ourselves in order to analyze and assess and stitch together the meaning making that a particular organism is undergoing. But that organism, say it's an oyster, an organism can't step out of its own umfeld in order to analyze the umfeld of a dodong.
So it's interesting, I guess, in terms of also the things that we respond to, the signs that are meaningful to us and how we can interpret them. So in a sense, there is still a bit of a hierarchy in the development of creatures that can interpret and empathize with other umwelt.
That's right.
And versus the signs and signifiers that exist in one other. So for instance, the amoeba would respond to very, very particular signs compared to a little Burmese cat.
That's absolutely true. And so, you know, I think one of the foundational assumptions for him is that living beings actually code their physical and chemical and material environments, and they code those environments in terms of the certain stimulus that will produce effects for action. And so there are some of these signs that will amplify our senses, and there are other kinds of tools in the body of the organism that will enable or assist one to realize the intention. I think one of the other interesting things about him and in this idea of this umfeld is that it is really a systems perspective.
Yes.
It's a whole panoply of a different network of signs and stimulus that come together and is interpreted by a particular living organism, and that system is itself never found alone, but is always found in part of an ongoing temporal relation with other systems and other signs.
That's really interesting. The plural of umwelt is umwelten, so our various worlds are interacting, and the signs that I'm recognizing in my world, you're also seeing and recognizing. I think that it's a holistic way of viewing the world, and it's interesting that it comes from a scientist that explores this really poetic perspective.
I kind of think about it. I mean, he uses the example of a soap bubble, and the soap bubble that you blow that produces a window upon the world, and so that you can look inside. And if you enter the soap bubble, you can see the world as it is presented to that particular living being. So from there, I don't know if you've seen those soap bubble artisans who are able to produce multiple soap bubbles upon one, and you get this big cluster of bubbles. And it seems like the proliferation of multiple umfelten in and as much as it, some parts overlap, some parts don't. It's like an amazing 3D Venn diagram.
What this requires then is that we must respond always to these stimulus, to these signs. This idea that all living beings, all living creatures have this capacity to experience and respond to. It isn't just that they respond to casual impulses. There has to be something existing in the world that they address, respond to.
And that they're almost coded to.
Yes.
That it's system input, lodging, contact, and then response.
A bottle of wine opens.
That's right. Ah, the bouquet.
Exactly.
The glass comes down.
A margarita.
Yes. Out come the limes.
Exactly. So for Uxkull then, all living organisms are in a sense autonomous because they have their own singular reactions to this stimuli in the world. This, as you said, this reaction that's even coded in their entire being. And so in a sense, thinking about the self, all living beings, all cells or all organisms have the capacity to behave as a self, as a subject in their world, as a self.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
It is absolutely amazing. And that's just such a good point, because I think it's the singularity with which we as human beings interpret our own selfhood, that I am Melanie sitting here speaking into this microphone here at this moment. And the capacity for the human privilege to think that we alone are the only ones is really challenged here in this moment, because from Uxkull's perspective, even if it's the species characteristics that represent the singularity of the organism, there is still a singularity of self, which does so much to challenge that kind of human sense of hierarchy and selfhood, that human selfhood alone. So I think it's a wonderful, wonderful insight.
We talked about Uxkull's invitation to this journey. So it would be nice to read an excerpt from his work.
It requires us to take a stroll, does it not?
Yeah.
Perhaps it should be called a stroll into unfamiliar worlds, worlds strange to us, but known to other creatures, manifold and varied as the animals themselves. End quote.
The best time to set out on a stroll like this, and an adventure like this, is a sunny day. And so you can imagine just closing your eyes and strolling down a flower-strewn meadow, humming with insects, butterflies, where you can glimpse the worlds of the lowly dwellers in the meadow.
It's just such an evocative turn of phrases there. I recall when I first read that that excerpt, it just made me think of being in a meadow on a summer's day. You know, that heat that comes from the sun that isn't too hot but comfortable. And you can hear insects buzzing, bzzz, and the wind comes up ever so gently and ruffles the grass and the flowers. And somehow you hear caw in the background, caw, caw, and then shh.
It's beautiful. But what I also think about is it doesn't have to be in a meadow now, on our own bodies. You know, dust mites, little mites on that crawling on our skin, flies in this stuffy room. These worlds coincide everywhere.
Well, that's right. Although I guess, what you've just pointed out to me is that I lack sufficient creativity. I'm like, oh, yes, we must go on a stroll. Not, oh, microbial agent, would you like to stroll along the thicket of hair on Melanie's arm?
And it would accept.
And it would accept. Oh, please.
We take a stroll in that meadow. We are in this little soap bubble. To take a glimpse into other worlds, we must wrap a soap bubble around each creature to represent its own world. And again, it's like interconnecting that Venn diagram of existences, of worlds. So each world comes into being, and we can see through the bubbles. We can sit and observe, and that's the capacity, I guess, of that human existence, a human essence, is to be able to observe the worlds of the Umwelts of other beings and other creatures. And as they appear to us, but also as it appears to them.
He says, you know, it's through this technique almost of blowing the soap bubble that provides a technique or a method or a signal to oneself that one is entering the other, the world of another, and that one adopts the lens from which to evaluate the world from the perspective of the being within that soap bubble. So if it's a burrowing mouse or a badger, one needs to approach the world from that vantage, from their lens, rather than to incorporate one's own perspective into that soap bubble.
But this is a technique that for someone like Descartes would be impossible to take on board, because for him the existence of the animal world is machinic. They're machines.
Well, and certainly the constraints also from his methodological approach, which is effectively a skepticism. The only thing that he can be sure of is himself. Mm-hmm. And so that ends up limiting his capacity to even postulate the existence of an Umfeld or a soap bubble, because he wouldn't actually be entirely clear that it existed and was real. He could, of course, be dreaming. So for Descartes, he's circumscribed by his own methodological approach. And here with Uxkull, we have a very particular methodological approach that is put in service of trying to offer non-human animals and other living creatures the capacity for selfhood by identifying those meaningful elements in their own world that they have the capacity to respond to. And certainly, as you said before, not every point of stimulus will be acted upon, but it's particular points of stimulus that are especially meaningful for the living organism that will be responded to and then elaborated in sequence.
One example that Uxkull gives is of a tick, just an ordinary tick.
What is a tick?
A tick is a tiny little organism that needs blood in order to survive. So it thrives on the bodies of living beings. But they can lay dormant for many years. And this I did not know until I came to read Uxkull. That they can just exist in the world on this blade of grass, completely suspended, and just wait until the moment where there's someone nearby that they can exist on and with.
When I was growing up, actually, I grew up in tree-laden areas, and in the trees there were always threats of ticks. And so when we went outside for recess at school, we always had to wear hats, not because in Canada one was necessarily so worried about sun safety, but because one was worried about tick safety.
Oh.
What is interesting about the tick, from we've learned from our discussion so far, is that the tick burrows.
Mm.
But what Uxkull helps us to see is the conditions that are required for the tick to suddenly release itself. One of the amazing things about the tick, and this is just astonishing to me, is that the tick lives in a rather unique and alternate temporal universe to us humans, in the sense that there have been recorded accounts of ticks living dormant for something like 17 years. And so they will just stay suspended from wherever they are located in the forest, waiting, 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 month after month, year after year, until there is a sign that appears that stimulates a biochemical response from the tick. And what's fascinating is it's the biochemical reaction to the smell of butyric acid.
Sweat.
Pong. That's just a fancy word for pong, folks. That's right. That's what causes the tick to fall. It sniffs, and then suddenly, lo and behold, there's the smell of sweat. If we think about the tick smelling the butyric acid, then it launches itself. And so this is one of those wonderful moments of that lyrical quality in Uxkull's text. He says, quote, "The eyeless tick is directed to this watchtower by a general photosensitivity of her skin. The approaching prey is revealed to the blind and deaf highwaywoman by her sense of smell. The odor of butyric acid that emanates from the skin glands of all mammals acts on the tick as a signal to leave her watchtower and hurl herself downwards. If in so doing she lands on something warm, a fine sense of temperature betrays this to her. She has reached her prey, the warm. If only remains for her to find a hairless spot. There she burrows deep into the skin of her prey and slowly pumps herself full of warm blood."
Thank you for that dramatic reading of Uxkull. I don't think anyone's ever read him that well.
Oh, I'm not sure. But what's interesting is that there are just, I mean, so if one thinks about how worked up that passage is, there are two things that the tick responds to. One is smell, and the smell is then, so long as the condition for heat is met in sequence, then the tick responds to heat. But it could well be that the tick would just smell butyric acid, hurl itself from the watchtower, and then land on the earth, and that would be it. But the quality of chance, the element of surprise, the quality of hope springs eternal here, where the tick has to hurl itself and then land, hopefully, on the warmth of a mammal. And landing on the warmth of the mammal will stimulate the next step in this sequence of various signs that stimulate the tick to act, and that is to burrow deep into the skin of the mammal, hopefully having found a hairless spot.
Really, what's happening here isn't just people might say, oh, it's just a chemical reaction. For Uxkull, it's so much more. It's about an exchange between two objects, a relationship between a living subject and its object. And in this sense, it's the tick as a living subject in this world responding to this being, this warm-blooded mammal entering its umwelt.
And I think that umwelt, that world is a meaningful world for the tick. The tick will hang suspended without meaning, so to speak, until there is a spark or that a sense of smell indicates that a mammal is present, and that becomes meaningful for the tick. And that meaning-making capacity, which is presumably necessary for selfhood, is something that Uxkull wants to accord all living beings.
This is the amazing thing, right? We think of our own existence, of our own world, and the things that make meaning to us. Our world is so full of things that make meaning, and we don't consider the world of a tick as a meaningful, or a tick in terms of existing in a relation that produces meaning. And I think it's just wonderful when we think of our own existence or other beings' existence. There's meaning everywhere, and just the way that we accord or signify signs with meaning, that this is the key difference for Uxkull. And I think it's really wonderful to accord that sense of selfhood, that sense of subjecthood to all beings.
Yeah, well, your comments actually make me reflect that one of the qualities of his contribution is to check that presumptiveness about where and how meaning is created, and who has the capacity for meaning making, and the presumption that the capacity for making meaning is limited to Homo sapiens, so to speak, is something quite intriguing when one thinks about the sheer number of living organisms in this world, from plants to microbes to reptiles and other mammals. It's quite extraordinary that from this particular lens that Ukskul gives us, we have the capacity to see all of these living creatures engaged in a very complex, mutually reinforcing acts of meaning making. So it gives us that sense of holism that you were speaking of in a genuinely ecological perspective, I suppose, insofar as we think about the way in which systems of meaning are created.
Do we also carry meaning for other beings?
If one has a pet, I suppose, you know, yeah. I'm just thinking about a pet or a partner or a child, you know, that there's a way in which meaning making is not just strictly that which occurs between subject and object, but that meaning making is also something that is created through interaction with other humans. So Ukskul's line of argument looks at that relationship between subject and object, but certainly we can think about the relations between subjects as creating the conditions for developing and extending a whole life world.
I think this was a really meaningful discussion today, Melanie.
Thank you, Nama. Always wonderful to hang out with you here in this very hot studio. I am very conscious of the prospect of butyric acid. So it is shocking how warm it is in here.
Well, it's just us and our butyric acid and various dust mites.
Indeed. Well, thank you so much for listening to another episode of You Can't Say That.
Oh, do we know how to say it in German?
Nein.
Yeah, if any of our followers speaks German, please tell us how to say it. You can't say that in German.
Das kann man nicht sagen.
Das kann man nicht sagen.
Oh, very good. You did a better job, I think. Thank you for joining us on Das kann man nicht sagen.
Das kann man nicht sagen.
We'll see you.
Mein Name ist Melanie White. Und
Name Carlin. Oh, mein Name. Und mein Name ist Name Carlin.
Deine Name.
Auf Wiedersehen.
Guten Abend. Oops.
We know it.
You Can't Say That is a Carlin White collaboration. Francesca Rimi Cheng designed our logo. Our theme song was composed by Stephen Hunt. Christo Fuertes.
Spring to meine Blase.
Thanks for joining us. And we'll see you next time.